Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Time for movies. I love the movies, and so do most of you. And today, we're going to talk about a mess of new independent films that will have you racing to the nearest theaters to check them out. Our film critics are in the house, and they are film professor Cynthia Haynes. Cynthia, always good to have you here.
Thank you very much, Steve.
KCUR Steve Walker is back. Steven.
I am, thanks.
And Bob Butler, who reviews films for the Kansas City Star. You can read his reviews at butlerscinemascene.com. Robert, how are you?
Doing great. Always a pleasure.
Well, here we go again, and let's get right to it. And Cynthia, let's talk about Effie Gray playing at the Tivoli and the Glenwood Arts. It's the story of a young wife of renowned art critic John Ruskin, who lives a life of despair.
It's a period costume drama. It is, there's definitely an audience out there for this kind of film, but I have to warn you, it's the most maudlin, depressing movie I've seen in a long time.
I read that about it.
And unfortunately, the movie ends where her life begins, and we've got Dakota Fanning, I think, miscast in this role.
You think?
I think.
Wow. Maybe?
Okay,
maybe.
Yes. Wow. Dakota Fanning. Miscast. So it was written, the screenplay was written by Emma Thompson, and she's featured in the film as a woman named Lady Eastland.
Who already has an Oscar for writing the screenplay for Sense and Sensibility for Ang Lee. She's no slouch in that.
Go figure. And she even brings a feminist tone to this story. It's a very sad story. Greg Wise plays Ruskin, who is selfish, arrogant. Wonderful Julie Walters plays Ruskin's mother, and she is the possessive mother-in-law from hell, no doubt about that. The wonderful Claudia Cardinale has a very brief appearance in the film, and it's really kind of sad to see what some actresses will do, and I'm making assumptions here, to continue to make movies, and that's, you know, get a facelift.
Hey, I'm a little shocked to see Emma Thompson herself in a dowager role.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, time
flies.
It certainly does.
And the movie comes just, like, what, 2 weeks after Mr. Turner closes, and
same set of characters.
Ruskin was a huge patron of Turner.
Mm-hmm.
And Turner is mentioned. A piece of Turner's work is in the house and discussed.
And that's one of the suggestions I would have for Richard Laxton, who is the director of this film, is to see what a master filmmaker like Mike Lee can do with a period costume drama like this one.
Well, you're saying it's kind of a drag.
Can I add that it's Ruskin and this Dakota Fanning character, the title character, Effie Gray, get married. She's like a child bride, barely out of her teens, maybe. And they have a troubled relationship.
To say the least.
Consummation is way delayed, let's just say that. But she actually is supposed to be sexually voracious and starved for affection. And I told Cynthia, Dakota Fanning totally wrong for this. But if Keira Knightley had played it, she would have played those scenes where she's tearing her skin off.
Mm-hmm.
And Dakota Fanning's just a sight.
Bland.
Oh,
yeah.
Bland. We all said bland. Yeah. Bland,
just,
bland.
She kind of has that deer in the headlights look.
Exactly. Throughout the movie.
How does this happen? I mean, you have smart people making a film. How does
it's
that
not
happen?
Like Dakota Fanning's, like, brings in billions of dollars.
Well, here's something else. In the annals of British social history, the Effie Gray scandal was really that, a scandal. A woman who leaves her husband, who will not have sex with her, and marries a painter, Millais. And they lived happily ever after.
Huh.
Now,
so you knew this story?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, really?
This is a big deal. And yet the movie comes off not as a scandal, but merely as sort of this weepy, you know.
Yeah.
Right, and it ends before she starts her life with her new husband.
Right. And you're like, what's the point?
Yeah.
A little bit,
yeah. And that happened, as far as I'm concerned, in Unbroken also.
Yes.
And when his life begins, that's when the movie ends.
I still don't understand. I mean, help me.
What
here.
Do you want to know?
How can all this money and effort and time and all these people collaborate and produce a film that seems to miss the mark like this one appears to have done?
It misses the mark in the casting. I think everyone else in the film is fine.
The irony is that Dakota Fanning is an American playing a Brit, and we have so many Brits these days playing Americans in movies.
Well, it's only fair.
And why they couldn't, you know, cast...
I don't know. Someone, again, behind the scenes, are there favors doled out? I don't know.
Or maybe someone else was cast in the film and bailed at the last minute. And, you know, so who knows? But
we do have a clip here from Effie Gray.
Which kind of sums it all up.
You want to set it up?
Yes, Emma Thompson's character is talking to Effie, and she's relating her trials and tribulations of being with Ruskin.
Let me understand you. You are telling me that you still, to this day, do not understand the details of the most intimate relation within marriage. You have not experienced them.
He has never so much as touched me. Never made me his wife. Because he was disgusted with my body that first evening. After that, he said we should wait until I was 25. By then, he said that I professed such a dislike for him that it would be a sin. And an even further sin to have children. Because I was wicked. And probably insane. And he has never, after that moment, sought relations. Never.
You know, I got to say, Emma Thompson sells it anyway.
Oh yeah.
You know, I'm gonna make the point again. I'm still looking, Robert. We've spent our careers working in newsrooms where if you produce a story that's not quite up to snuff, it gets rewritten and you work on it until it's a presentable piece of writing. And I'm wondering how can it be in a. I understand a movie's a whole different animal.
I think, but how
can it be that you can produce something that's mediocre when all these people are working on it, trying to make it something else?
It was the mistake made at the inception by Emma Thompson to focus on this part of the story, and it becomes so incomplete and so downbeat that it just, you know, the grounds
people recognize the situation halfway through and say, wait, we're missing the mark here.
You know what?
That could be day one. Think about all the money spent on pre-production. They've got the costumes. Put together.
And at some point, you can only spend so much money.
And at the end of day one, had I been on the set with any power, I would have said, Fanning's not cutting it. We need to rethink this.
You know what? Here's what you got to understand, though. Maybe the only reason they got money is because they knew that Dakota Fanning is an American actress. People recognize her. She's a household name. You know, there are all these totally non-artistic considerations mm-hmm. that come into play here. And once you get a juggernaut rolling, pulling the plug is really difficult.
Well, she is the weak link.
The rest
of the actors, I think, did a terrific
job.
I
don't know if any actors could have made this person, you know, that watchable.
Knightley could have.
Yeah, it's a pretty glum role.
Okay, the first film is Effie Gray. I'm sort of sensing three thumbs down around the table here. Am I right there? Okay.
Semi,
in the middle, I think.
In the middle, okay. Yeah. Let's see if we can turn this around a little bit with the next film, Backcountry, Cynthia. A young couple's romantic camping trip becomes a tale of survival when they are attacked by a man-eating bear. This is based on a true story.
This is a movie that's an hour and a half long that should have been about 15 minutes. It was written by and directed by Adam McDowell, and he claims this film was inspired by an Ontario couple's real-life nightmare. A very attractive young actress, Missy Peregrine, plays a lawyer named Jen, and Jeff Roop, also a very attractive young man, plays Alex, her boyfriend. They're on a backpack trip in Canada, and they're ill-equipped because he's an arrogant guy and says, oh, they don't need a map, and he takes her cell phone out of her backpack because he doesn't want her talking on the phone while they're having this weekend together. And I kind of was hoping that this might or might not do for bears what Jaws did for, you know, sharks, but...
Or Cujo did for St. Bernard's.
For St. Bernard's. But, you know, a quarter into the film, you've got the snout of a bear, belonging to a bear, pushing up against the tent that this couple is in and doing a number on the guy. And then she spends the rest of the movie outrunning the bear on her way to
outrunning
safety.
A grizzly bear.
a grizzly bear.
Which are faster than quarter horses over a quarter mile or something like that.
Yeah. So I suggest watch Wild or Grizzly Man in lieu of watching this movie. If you're looking for a scary movie, I mean, you ought to try It Follows. But there's a reason that movie works and this one doesn't, is because you see this cuddly black bear and...
I wouldn't call him cuddly, really.
Well,
I mean, it is really, truly scary when his nose is poking through their tent and you hear that and that sniffing.
Okay, I got to tell you, I know this isn't a great movie. I thought it was extremely effective on a low budget and in the delayed terror category. You go almost an hour without even seeing the bear.
Right.
But noises in the woods at night while you're laying in your bed.
A print in the,
you know,
in the mud.
They're asleep. You hear huffing and puffing outside the tent and then the unmistakable snout of a bear presses against the canvas. I think in the way that it delays the delivery, it was...
Gentlemen,
I thought it was done really well.
I can say I liked it.
You know, just the premise is intriguing to me. I spent a summer in Cloud National Park, and we would my shift would be in the afternoon, so we could oftentimes go out and hike in the mornings. And you'd get up on the trail at 6:37 in the morning, be the first persons out, and on the trail you'd see the footprints of grizzly bears who had walked there during the evening, hopefully several hours before, but you're always very aware of the fact that they could be there, and you're making noise, you're wearing bells, and always, that was a summer where you're very aware of what might happen.
I have to issue a warning. This probably has the most grisly graphic bear attack scene I have ever witnessed.
Yeah.
Scary stuff.
Yeah.
Well, what's the clip we have from Backcountry, Cynthia?
Yes, the bear arrives.
All right.
That's the setup. I think we
written
get
written by William Shakespeare.
Yeah.
What do we do? We don't have food in here.
I know.
Oh, where's my axe?
Is it in your bed?
That's been back by the fire.
What do we do? What do we do? We don't have to
That sounds like a pretty cheap sound effect.
It's more effective
over and over and over again. Yeah,
I didn't think it was very good because I didn't think the actors were very good. I think the script's pretty pedestrian. She says
it's minimal.
She says at one point, "We haven't seen anyone in so long. They saw someone 24 hours ago before that." And it just was like, why?
Well, you're saying thumbs down, Steve Walker, Cynthia Haynes. You're not.
It's not.
This didn't work.
I'm going to give it a moderate up.
Okay.
Yeah, well, that's
we're
fine.
Not our batting average ain't too good here as the Royals begin their season on Monday. Okay, Wild Tales, a film I saw Steve Walker. This is an anthology of six tales of vengeance from Argentina, and this thing is a hoot.
It's great. It's director Damien Zifron. I don't know how to pronounce his name, but it was up for best foreign language film. Which got beat by Ida from Poland, but this movie is just terrific, and it's six tales about revenge, but told in six so different ways,
yes,
and six very different lengths. The first one is like 4 minutes and is over with the credits, before the credits start. And then there's one about road rage, which we talked about before the show, that's really like a Coen Brothers movie because it's so crazy
and been violent. Sticking with me. So crazy, so violent, and watchable.
And and then there's one, for example, about that talks about class issues. Mm-hmm. This rich man's son is involved in a hit and run, and his father convinces the family gardener to take the fall for it, which was really infuriating. And then the last film is really kind of really fun and funny, and it's about a wedding from hell. Again, we overuse that cliche, but the bride sees on her new groom's phone a number from, and it's to a woman who's also at the reception, and she takes off on this plan to humiliate, one up, et cetera, him, all in the name, of course, of getting some revenge that she feels like she earns. It's a really terrific movie.
Cynthia?
I just would like to forewarn people that the first short film is very disturbing in light of the
Lufthansa
airplane crash. So.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Because
right.
it's a story of a deranged pilot who mm-hmm. yeah does something with his plane. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. And what did you think of a Wild?
Oh, I thought I didn't know where it was going. I mean,
right.
You know, one would be very.
Which I loved about it. By
which
yeah.
is what I loved about it too.
About this
is
experience.
One was hilarious, and the next one is dark and disturbing, and then the
right.
next one is amusing, and then, so it's just it was a very smart thing to do.
No cliches here, I thought.
No,
in
I
the
mean,
of these films.
It's hard to talk about because you don't want to give up how each little film turns.
Like an O. Henry, I mean, it's stories.
There's one in a diner involving this older, really masculine female cook and a young waitress, and in walks someone who's had an impact on the waitress's family. But so these little things come out, and you're like, okay, how far is this going to go?
Mm-hmm.
How bloody will it be? How funny? How strange? I mean, I just loved it.
The influence of the Coen brothers you mentioned certainly seemed evident to me. Absolutely. Again, that film...
And it's in Spanish, so we don't have a clip from it.
An anthology of six tales of vengeance. It's titled Wild Tales. It's at the Tivoli and the Glenwood Arts. Okay. Let's move on here to a film, It Follows. This is a coming-of-age horror story, Steve Walker, and a sexual transmitted disease allegory, if you will.
Yeah. David Robert Mitchell wrote and directed this. The allegory is true because it's sort of about a group of young people, maybe just out of high school.
The lead actress is in college.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
She and her boyfriend have relations, as Emma Thompson so delicately puts it in the first clip. And then zombies start appearing.
Shape-shifting,
is that what they're called?
Yeah.
So the way she can avoid getting taken or, what would you say, hurt by, eaten by?
Destroyed
by. Is to pass it on, meaning, okay, is this a metaphor for HIV, for sexually transmitted diseases? Because the it that they keep talking about, it's out there. It's going to affect you. It's so oblique and
vague.
Vague. I started to think, no, the it is not an HIV metaphor. It is about a reputation, a young woman's reputation, perhaps.
Do you remember in the early days of slasher films?
Yeah, probably.
The surest way to have a maniac show up with a knife is to be a teenager having sex. Remember?
Right, yeah.
You think this is any way is a comment on that sort of view that sex is a killing experience?
The director made a comment that in this day and age, kids will do something on the internet that they will live to regret, that they will never, ever be able to remove from their reputation.
And if he says that, that goes right to the reputation theory, that these zombies are really standing in for a young person's reputation. Once you've lost your virginity, you can't go back.
You see you see the story this week about the CEO that says before he hires anybody, he follows their internet trail? Anything they have ever written on the internet?
Which can destroy careers, right.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
There are two things about this film. One is... No, there are no cell phones. There is no texting. There's
I didn't
no
even notice that, actually.
The TV sets are in black and white. You kind of don't know what era this film is set in.
And it's set in Detroit, which is interesting because the kids live in a fairly nice neighborhood, but they party in homes that have been completely shut
Right, so the contrast between
abandoned.
Decay and the kind of middle class life that they lead.
The movie they go to, too, is Charade, which is an old Cary Grant, Audrey Hepburn.
Yes, so it's kind of a throwback and to the old sci-fi movies, because that's what's showing is, I think, It or The Thing is one of the first things they're looking at on television. But I think what really makes this movie is Disaster Piece. That is the name of the group that put the soundtrack together. And I think the director of Backcountry would benefit from watching a film like this with a very effective, scary soundtrack. The other thing I appreciate, I think a very young teenager could see this film. I mean, there was no graphic sex scenes. There was no really graphic violence. And, I thought that was highly unusual, and if in this day and age, there was an ad that says the, let's see, where did I have it? The best horror movie in over a decade is the big headline on the ads that you'll see in the newspaper. And I thought, well, maybe this is worth seeing. And if you read the fine print, it's from Boing Boing, which is some sort of group blog. Well, no, and we all know about Bob.
Yeah,
your
I think that's overstated.
About a month and a half, the Babadook? How would
right.
you compare this to the Babadook?
Babadook is 10 times better.
Oh, really? Okay,
yeah,
there
yeah.
you go.
I didn't think this was particularly scary. I couldn't understand what the it was. Like I said, is it a metaphor for HIV, for a reputation? Anyway, we're going to hear a clip of the kids sitting on a sofa reminiscing about finding some dirty magazines when we hear that the intruders are outside because someone has had sex and intruders follow.
This is from It Follows.
We were such stupid kids.
Ridiculous.
Yeah, we're all sitting out on Greg's front lawn with a dozen dirty magazines just sprawled out everywhere, and we're laughing.
I didn't even realize how bad it was.
Oh, and Greg's mom. Remember her face when she came out and saw us being that?
I just scooped it up so fast. And then she called my mom. Kelly, I got the sex ed talk the next day.
I got one too.
Good luck.
There's a broken window in the kitchen, but no one there.
Are you sure?
Yeah, I mean, whoever broke it must have run away.
Maybe we should call the police.
I'm gonna go wake up your sister. She should call.
No adults to be found anywhere.
Yeah.
You can hear the amateurish cast, I think, also made it less thrilling for me.
Mm-hmm.
Their line readings are
thumbs
pretty
up,
wild.
Thumbs down.
Thumbs down for me.
If you're curious and into scary movies,
think about it. Okay. Well, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with our independent film critics, Cynthia Haynes, Steve Walker, and Bob Butler. We'll turn to Three Hearts, 71, The Gunmen, and some coming attractions. We'll talk about some of the hot new shows on Netflix and HBO and a whole bunch more. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed our discussion with the ethics professors on religious freedom or working while physically or mentally ill, you can hear that conversation at kcur.org. On Monday, we'll be broadcasting live from the K for the Royals' home opener, an annual up-to-date outing. Always enjoy it a lot. Monday, live from the K for opening day with the Royals. Well, this hour, we're live with our film critics, Cynthia Haynes, Steve Walker, and Bob Butler. Read his reviews at butlerscinemascene.com. Always good to have them here in the house. And here we go. We'll keep on moving along here. Bob Butler, let's go to Three Hearts. This is a French romantic triangle with a twist.
This is proof that everything sounds better in French. A film with such that relies so heavily on coincidence that if it was in English, you'd laugh it off the screen. And yet somehow, because of the actors involved and because it's French and, you know, you assume they have something up their sleeve, the French, you hang with it. What you've got here, the film is from Benoît Jacquot, and it's about a fellow named Mark. He's played by a guy who's known mostly as a comedian, a guy named Benoît Poulvord, who 25 years ago made a tremendous movie I love called Man Bites Dog. It was a faux documentary. Anyway, he's stranded in this provincial town. He misses the last train. He meets a woman, played by Charlotte Gainsbourg. They walk around all night. They agree to meet in Paris in a few days to see if they want to continue this relationship. Do they exchange phone numbers? No. Do they exchange names? They forgot. So the meeting would have come off. They were both there, but they missed. He goes back to the town. The woman has left the town, but she's left behind her family. He meets another woman, played by Chiara Mastroianni. Huh. He meets the sister. He falls in love with her. He meets her. He marries her. And several months into the marriage, he happens to look at the family portrait and realize the woman he'd almost had a connection with is the sister of the woman he is now married to.
Oh.
And they dread getting back together, and there's tension because what's going to happen, and broken hearts, and two hearts, and three hearts, and... I like the acting. I found the whole thing vaguely ridiculous. Anybody else?
Well, the fun for me was to realize that Kiara, who plays Sophie in the film, is actually the daughter of Catherine Deneuve.
Ironic.
So
that explains those eyes.
Family resemblance.
Oh,
family
yeah.
Family resemblance. Yeah. You better believe
Not
it.
Not a bad thing.
Yeah.
Nope.
And I think Charlotte Gainsbourg is just one of the best actresses
around.
Well,
that's what I mean about her selling the preposterous.
In any language, there's a scene where you see her face behind her sister, and she has this realization. And it changes in about 14 ways in about 8 seconds. And it's just incredible. I liked it a lot better than you, Bob. I mean, yeah, sure, there are conveniences. But what movie isn't filled with conveniences in order to tell its story?
I had a little problem with the leading man, who I thought was kind of colorless. That two women would go heads over heels for him just struck me
that's
as
what I thought,
vaguely
yeah.
improbable.
Yeah, that's
Cynthia, what'd you think?
I agree with Bob. I found it entertaining. Loved watching those actors on screen. And yes, there were preposterous moments, but it was it's worth seeing.
Okay,
it is worth seeing. Yes.
Worth seeing. Three hearts. At least we got one on the board here that somebody agrees on. This has been a little bit of a struggle this hour.
Well, I think Wild Tales. We did
Wild Tales. That's right. Let's move on to 71. In 1971, Belfast, a British soldier is trapped behind enemy lines, Bob Butler. The title of the film, again, is just
71, like as in the year 71. Well, you know, this is one of the oldest war stories, you know, trapped behind enemy lines. But what do you do when the enemy lines are so vague that you don't know who's a friend and who's an enemy? Jack O'Connell, who played the lead in Unbroken, young British actor, plays a private in the British Army. He's assigned to Northern Ireland. There's kind of an in-joke at the beginning where his commanding officer says, don't worry, you're not leaving our country. Since Northern Ireland is, you know, good luck with that.
Mm-hmm.
On the first mission out to search some houses that's on the line between the Catholic and the Irish neighborhood, they're attacked by a mob. The soldiers run away. Our man is left behind. How do you survive? The Catholics want to kill him. He's being chased by gunmen from the IRA. He steals clothes to cover his uniform. He runs. He doesn't know if the little kid he meets in the alley is a good guy, a bad guy. Turns out the Protestants hate him as much as the Catholics do because the Protestants don't like the British coming down on their anti-Catholic terrorist campaign. So everybody's out to get this poor kid. And how do you survive through 24 hours of running around a city you don't understand when everybody wants to kill you, basically? It's a nail-biter. I thought it was extremely effective. And then there's a wonderful twist in that the British Army has a undercover crew of infiltrators who infiltrate the Catholic community to foment dissent and assassinate people, and this kid stumbles on their activity, so now he's got this group of the British Army after him as well.
Mm. Cynthia, Steve, what
That's
do you think?
I agree with Bob. I thought it was really riveting and entertaining, and the whole theme being you're supposed to kill. The person you're supposed to kill is right in front of you, but you don't have it in you.
Yeah.
Or you're still not sure. There's still so much uncertainty. You can't tell a crap like from a Protestant on the street.
Mm-hmm.
But the period we forget how bad it was, you know, and how violent it was for so long.
And the story's been told before, but I think this is very well done, and it's quite a commentary on the horrors of war. The one thing I would have wished for, subtitles.
Yeah, we have a clip here of him encountering this kid in an alley.
Who's offering to...
He doesn't know if the kid is on his side or going to take him to the bad guys or what.
Hmm.
If you can understand what the kid's saying, please translate.
Yes,
this is from 71.
Please don't bring them back in. Stay quiet.
A soldier? A real soldier? Brilliant. What boy is he in?
I don't know, I was in a school.
Is he McGarry? Paul Sparks? Hollywood?
I don't know, what are you doing out anyway? Get home.
I'm home. You lost? Come on, I'll take you back to your barracks. Come on, I'll take you to your barracks. It's up to you. What else are you going to do?
I'm told that dialogue is in English.
Let me say that there's a new show on the Travel Channel I've really been enjoying. It's only three episodes in, called Breaking Borders, where a journalist and a chef go to, they went to Palestine and had Jewish people and Palestinian people sit down for a meal and talk about their borders. The second one was in Belfast, and they brought Catholics and Protestants together who had been very involved in the fight, and they had a big meal. Not everyone gets along. I mean, it's like food doesn't save the world, but it's a very interesting show and very well done.
That film, again, is 71, and we got three thumbs up on that one,
yes,
if I'm hearing correctly and divining properly.
Okay.
Again, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date. We're talking about the latest independent films now showing. Let's go to another film. This is Sean Penn. The film is titled The Gunman, Cynthia Haynes. It's about a former sniper seeking redemption, and why not?
Yes, this is an addition to the genre of middle-aged men as protectors and avengers. We make reference to women aging on screen. We've got Liam Neeson, who's kind of set things off with Taken, who's 62 years old.
Thank you for calling that middle-aged.
And Denzel Washington, who happens... it's just... I guess Sean Penn's attempt to cash in on the success of the Taken movies. I think the filmmaker actually...
Well, I would say it's a blatant attempt. Even the director is the guy who directed
first Taken movie. Sean Penn plays Jim Terrier, a gun for hire. He spends way too much time with his shirt off. I guess he's trying to...
Well, he put all that money into his personal trainer. He's not going to...
Not going to let that money go to waste. And maybe others might feel differently. Cynthia, who knows?
Charlize Theron does, who he's seeing.
Yeah.
There are two stories going on here. We've got a multinational companies exploiting emerging economies, and we have a midlife crisis action film with a love interest. It's set in the Congo. A civil war is raging, and Penn's character poses as a security guard for a firm building a landing strip, but something else is going on here, and he's asked to assassinate a Congolese minister of resources. It's based on the novel The Prone Gunman by Jean-Patrick Manchette. Penn was the co-screenwriter and producer, and I kind of feel that this was pretty much a vanity project.
Or a vanity project, or is this a film that it aimed at making money so he can make films he really wants to make?
I don't know. I think this has done more damage for his career.
Yeah, I don't think it did anything at the box office.
Yeah. Well, it's still showing around Kansas City, so there is some interest in it. But if you're expecting Liam Neeson in the Taken films, you're not going to get it.
Okay, we have a clip here from The Gunman.
Yes, this is Javier Bardem, who's playing Felix, Sean Penn's friend, who was involved in this covert operation. And that's a conversation between the two of them.
You asked me here to give me some information, so give me information.
Here, yeah. Some information, right? It appears your old friends and me are on a congressional subpoena list.
We shouldn't be long before we have Interpol on our backs.
Into advancing Kinshasa, Democratic Republic of Congo in 2006. Well, that was only a matter of time. See, Cox is on the list. What about Reed and Bryson?
Well, that's an interesting part of the story. I found obituaries for both Reed and Bryson.
Of the three shooters, you're the only one left.
You know, I love Javier Bardem, but he was so over the top in this.
That's what he sort of does, though, isn't it?
More so than the Bond movie?
Well, okay, maybe I don't like Javier Bardem that much.
Okay, that's The Gunman, and maybe not, I guess, is
the
verdict here from our critics on the Sean Penn film. Okay, moving right along. Let's go to a film that's has some interest attached to it. It's titled Diplomacy. It's a story of a German general ordered to destroy Paris during World War II, based on a stage play and maybe based on a true story here, too.
Oh, sure. Yeah, right. It's 1944. The Allied forces are closing in on recapturing Paris, and two men have a conversation One of them wants to put Hitler's plan in place to make Paris, quote, a field of rubble as payback. There are bombs that are attached to everything from Notre Dame to the Louvre to the Eiffel Tower. Every bridge in Paris except the one the Germans will use to get out of town on. And it came really close to this happening. And what diplomacy is about, thus the title, or the German general who could put it in place with one phone call, and
Swedish diplomat.
Would have described the visitor, who, and they have a conversation for 90 minutes, because we know how it ends. Paris didn't blow up.
Yeah.
But it's still as suspenseful as all get out.
Well, and because both personalities are not as clear-cut as you'd think. The Nazi, you think, is, well, he's just a bad guy. Then you find out that Hitler has taken his family and there'll be reprisals if he doesn't follow through. He doesn't really want to blow up, you know, all this great heritage, but he might. The Swedish diplomat, you think he's a really great guy, and at the end of the movie you realize that he probably would have done anything up to and including assassination if it would stop this from happening. So no one is, it isn't just a black and white story. There's a lot of subtlety. Now, of course, this isn't the first time that this has been tackled in the movies. Back in 65, there was a movie called Is Paris Burning? The difference is that was a Hollywood production with a cast of thousands, international stars out the wazoo, so it was a big panoramic, you know, attempt. This is the same thing, different story. I actually like this. I call this, you know, hand-to-hand acting.
Yeah, I didn't see the other one, but
this is two actors on stage.
Well,
for the
there's some
film.
Other actors too. There's a guy who's waiting at the other end of the phone, saying, "Is he going to call me so we can put the plan in place?" But Nordland.
But there actually are bombs set to detonate.
Oh, they're ready.
Strategic locations.
Yes.
The Allies found them when they came into the city.
Oh,
everything was wired.
And you think about, I remember the first time I saw New York City after the Twin Towers were gone, and you see the void. You see more of a void than the buildings that were there. And so I kept thinking about, that's what you think about as they're moving towards the story. What would Paris look like with all of these landmark?
The plan was to blow the Seine out of its banks and flood several square miles of Paris, and they figured they would have had a million casualties had that happened.
And another interesting thing is that the guy who talks him out of it appeals to his name in history. What will your name be for your children and their children for years to come if you make that call?
Yeah, if you destroy the city.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. I've seen only the previews for this film in the theater, and you're sitting there watching it thinking, you mean somebody is diabolical enough to want to destroy Paris of all places? You almost can't believe it.
Well, Hitler was Hitler's revenge. German cities were being blown his payback.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to everything else Hitler had a hand in.
So this is this is an interesting,
it's very lively
film.
It's not over long. It's like 90 minutes of really intense acting.
Yeah.
Oh, that sounds great.
Yeah.
I was sort of hesitating
really
to go
seeing.
See it, but maybe
it's
very,
you saw it too.
Yeah.
It's a very smart movie. It's really worth your time, Steve.
Okay.
Especially if you're interested, since you are so interested in politics.
Yeah. Diplomacy. This is showing at the Tivoli, again, the story of a German general ordered to destroy Paris during World War II. Three thumbs up from our critics for that one. That is very good news. Okay, let's turn to video on demand as we sit here with our film critics, Steve Walker, Cynthia Haynes, Bob Butler. By any means, we're sort of through with our new films here. If our listeners have seen any of these films and want to chime in and give us a shout, by all means, do so. 816-235-2888 is our phone number, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. If you have a quick review, you want to offer us something you've seen, you want to offer us your opinion, we're all ears. 816-235-2888. Okay, video on demand here. Let's turn to home viewing and see what's available on demand that you might recommend to everyone.
There's a lot on demand right now, but what documentary I want to recommend that never played here is Happy Valley. It's the documentary about Penn State and Paterno and Sandusky and how the town and the college dealt with the horrifying news that Sandusky may have sexually assaulted numerous boys that he was mentoring. And the movie follows that whole story. We thought we knew everything, but to see it again in a compressed kind of way, we see these events that unfolded over several months, compressed into this hour and a half, including an interview with the boy that eventually he lied at first, the one who had been adopted by the Sandusky family, and then said, I cannot continue this lie. Mm. So he's featured quite a bit. It's really something.
So you learn something from this.
Oh, yeah.
It's interesting, the documentary format. Another, when you mentioned the idea of it compressing all this stuff and putting it into a digestible, you know, work, I think the same thing can be said about Going Clear, the Scientology documentary that's on HBO, Alex Gibney,
right.
Because it takes years, decades of stuff and compacts it. And sometimes you don't see a big picture if you're just looking at parts stretched out
that's
over time.
That's a great point. I think that's a really good way to describe documentaries.
But we also have to be very careful about who's telling the truth. Mm-hmm. Whose truth are we listening to?
Is that hard to tell in this film or
in every documentary? Mm-hmm. I am so skeptical these days when I watch these films, especially Coming Clear. Not that I'm necessarily a defender of Scientology or the filmmaker's other work, but you know, again, you stop and think: who's telling the story? Who are these talking heads, and what do they have to gain or to lose by this story?
We have a clip from Happy Valley of a student demonstrator, a big fan of Paterno's, talking about what happened the night the college kind of erupted over the news that Paterno was being let go.
This is from Happy Valley, a video on demand.
I was just so angry, so I took that picture I have of Joe, and I just stood out there on my balcony with it. And I got like a bunch of texts from family and stuff saying like, "Good job, you're on TV representing Joe." We got a lot of backlash for that event that night, that riot as they call it, even though I wouldn't really call it a real riot. I would call it a protest. That's definitely a better word for it. I don't think it was unwarranted. You know, this man was treated so badly. This guy was Penn State, and he built this place. How could they do this to him? How could they do this?
And my answer is, how could Paterno have let Sandusky do what he did?
Yeah, that was the central issue and what drove Joe Paterno to the place that drove him. Yeah, Cynthia?
I heard on NPR yesterday that efforts are being made at Penn State to reinstate Paterno to some extent.
You see in this documentary the extraordinary scene of them painting over Sandusky's body in this mural they have of all the people involved it's a pretty powerful movie.
And that scene we just listened to, there were what, thousands of people?
Thousands.
Which is just amazing. Yeah. And I
remember at the time thinking, what about the kids?
You know, there's something almost, how shall I say this, Germanic about this sort of being part of the rush of, you know, this is our identity.
This is who we are.
You know, and like facts don't really matter anymore.
Mm-hmm. Right. Their passion for the game and all of that kind of got took over.
I was just going to say, Bob, you have some information about the Kansas City...
I do. The Kansas City Filmmakers, or the Kansas City Film Society, is having a screening of a film. Now, Jean-Luc Godard's Goodbye to Language 3D. Jean-Luc Godard, the great and, frankly, rarely seen in this country French film director, made a 3D movie. It's like a lot of his movies. There's no plot, a lot of little vignettes. It's shot in 3D, I have to tell you, amazing 3D. It played here briefly at the Crown Center Theater, but they're doing a fundraiser. It's going to be at the Alamo Draft House on April 9th. That's a Thursday. And tickets are $20, $10. You go to the Film Society of Kansas City website, and you can get the information. If you haven't seen a Godard film in recent years, it's worth looking at just to know that there are people who are out there pushing the boundaries of cinema. This is not a conventional movie. It's a challenge, but it's really pretty cool.
In 3D?
In 3D.
KC Film Fest is happening April 14th, I believe, through the 17th. We have the dates. It's a little mini film fest with several narrative features, several documentary features, mm-hmm. lots of short films, pretty much housed within Cinemark on the Place, I believe. And I think their website is KC Film Fest. Is it not, Bob?
Yeah. Okay. I want to put in a plug for the Netflix series Bloodline, which I have watched all 13 episodes. The wife and I, we were riveted to the scene. It's a family saga about a family that runs a resort in the Florida Keys. Great acting, and there is a breakout performance by an actor named Ben Mendelsohn who plays the black sheep of the family. This guy, I've seen him in lots of movies, usually playing a drug addict or a petty crook. He's the kind of guy that you look at him, and I think he can make himself sweat on demand. he is brilliant as an almost Iago-type character that comes back to pay back the family that he thinks has turned its back on him.
What's the arc of the story?
The arc of the story, the bad son returns, they try to take him in, and he slowly starts unraveling everything while playing up to the mom that, you know, he's redeemed himself.
Kyle Chandler plays the dad.
Mom? The mom is Sissy Spacek.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, Sam Shepard is the father of the bunch.
So Chandler's a brother?
He's the brother who's also a cop. So he finds himself compromised between duty and family obligation. There's some really fine stuff going on here.
That's Sissy. I haven't seen her in anything for a long time.
She's good. She's good. Very good.
What series have lit you up, Cynthia, Steve, anything?
I'm watching Broadchurch on BBC America, which is an incredible. It's season two now of this great.
Broadchurch.
It's an area of England on these gorgeous cliffs that started last season with the murder of a child, and now the trial's going on.
Olive Kittredge. Just amazing performance by Frances McDormand. I just absolutely love it.
Is it a series on HBO?
Yes.
It's a two-nighter?
Mini-series, they called it. It's 4 hours long, I think. And also Justified, which is great fun.
Wow. Okay. We have some coming attractions here. Merchants of Doubt coming up on April 10th. What's that?
I saw that just yesterday. It's a documentary about the denying movement.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't...
Meaning what?
Don't fight climate change with facts. Just say, there's doubt about this, that no one knows for sure. Same thing they did with cigarettes. Well, we don't know if it causes cancer. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. The jury's out. Well, the jury isn't out unless you're paid to make it out, and that's what this is about.
Something to live for.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a little long.
I agree.
A little too many talking heads, but...
it makes a point.
It makes a very, very good point.
I told Cynthia I fell asleep as the opening credits were on, and I woke up with the closing credits running.
That's quite a performance
endorsement.
Best performance by a movie reviewer we've seen around here for a while.
Yeah. I'm tired.
That's Merchant of Doubt. Merchants of Doubt.
Yeah.
Okay.
I want to go back just briefly here about... documentary films. I think if you kind of looked at the list of films we recommended or enjoyed the most this past year, so many of them were documentaries, and they're entertaining, they're informative.
Yeah. Well, Cynthia and I went to True False again.
In
we
Columbia,
haven't talked
Missouri.
About that, but
oh, that was a great...
We saw 9 movies in 3 days.
Really?
Yeah. It's very fun.
Hard getting in to see them?
No. Mm-hmm. No, I think a lot of people got into things
so
that they
whatever
wanted
it is they
to
wanted
see.
To see. And they leave enough openings so that you know, they set aside a venue to show, you know, a
repeat
film
performance.
That's
exactly.
Where I saw the Scientology movie. Mm-hmm.
And also The Jinx,
The
Durst documentary. Yeah. And the filmmaker...
Remind our listeners what that's about, Cynthia.
Well, Robert Durst is the son of a wealthy real estate... developer in New York City, and he is accused of killing his first wife. They never found the body, and also a very good friend of his is killed execution style, and his neighbor was killed and dismembered, and so...
And he was acquitted for that
one. He claimed self-defense, and he had this bang-up lawyer. I'm telling you, if you ever get in trouble, he's the guy
you want
to
hire. Well,
he's
been in the news because the night after The Jinx closed on HBO, he was arrested because of something he says on a hot mic, which we all know now. He said, I killed them all.
Yeah.
I mean...
Yeah, there you
but
go.
This is what's happening, is that you no longer have... 60-minute documentaries or an hour-and-a-half documentaries. I mean, you might have an 8-hour documentary.
Yeah, this was 6 hours in all, was it not?
And again, this whole scene, the dynamics of the scene is of documentary films is changing dramatically because you can create an 8-hour documentary and break it up and show it on HBO or Showtime.
About another movie was The Staircase, which was about 6 hours, a documentary about a murder. Compelling stuff.
And two other things coming up, While We Were Young and The Riot Club. What about those?
Noah Baumbach's latest film is While We Were Young. It's with Ben Stiller and Naomi Watts. And it's taking a look at a couple who are in their 40s looking behind them. An even younger couple, a very hip couple, is coming along. And they're questioning their lives. And their relationship to another generation.
There's some problems in this film, but I really love the relationship between Stiller and Watts and Adam Driver from Girls, one of the best young actors going, and Amanda Seyfried played this couple in their 20s.
Well, Steve Walker, Cynthia Haynes, Bob Butler, thanks for all the great reviews. And 3 to C, we'll have them up on our website later on today. Their picks for the free best films now showing in area screens. Just go to kcur.org. You'll find your list. Thank you all very much. Appreciate
You're welcome.
It. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. Monday, we broadcast live from the K for the Royals home opener. Find out what's new out there and who the new faces are among our boys in blue. Our theme music is composed by Bobby Watson. We had help this week from KCUR's Linda Cher, Bill Brownlee, Danny Alexander, Lisa Rodriguez, Beth Lipoff, Eliza Spurtis, and Will Trumper. Our senior producer is Steven Steigman. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.